All right, the next part of our program is that we are going to have our first panel discussion, which is taking exactly where Ken left us off with a conversation of what are tomorrow's job skills, what are the challenges in getting there. And we do have a wonderfully knowledgeable panel that has volunteered or been drafted to share some of their ideas with us. And Tim's going to be moderating this panel. Come on up, Tim.
I'm going to introduce all the panelists. The focus of this discussion, as Julie said, is tomorrow's job skills, today's challenges. I'm going to introduce all of our speakers today, and then after which you're going to have 2 to 3 minutes to say some opening remarks. How we're going to do this in 30 minutes, I'm not sure, but we'll try to figure it out. So first we have Stephen B. Chesser, who is the Senior Manager, Community Relations for the Boeing Company. Our good friend, my good friend, Assemblywoman Lynn Doucher, who I just saw last week in Sacramento. Lisa Hughes, who is a student with us today from now famous Tribuco Hills High School. Yes. Cheryl Lee, who's a development executive with Apple Computer. Christine McCauley, who is the VP of Global Talent Management and Executive Compensation. Well, that's an interesting combination there. For Edwards Life Sciences. And then Dr. Cameron McCune from Fullerton School District. And Ryan Morrow, who's a senior at Tribuco Hills High School.
We should go first, does it matter?
So what I guess I'm supposed to allow each of you 2 to 3 minutes to issue an opening statement on the topic of tomorrow's skills, job skills, and today's challenges. So there's really no particular order. Maybe Dr. McCune, you want to open things up?
Sure, I'd be happy to. Well, I think the challenge that we have in education today is really trying to make sure that the stakeholders truly understand what our mission is and getting them aligned with where we're trying to go. I think many times we have educators who are prepared to move forward, but getting the community and people who still think that education should look like it looked like when they went to school is extremely difficult. And so I think making sure that the community, that our stakeholders are totally involved in the process and understand where we're trying to go so that we're not fighting that battle initially is a real challenge that we're having to deal with. The other part is the staff development component that we've heard about last night and again today. It is a critical need, and with limited resources, we have to be very creative in terms of how we're able to bring that staff development to make certain that our workforce are truly literate in terms of 21st century needs. And that's something in Fullerton we've been working very hard on. We've done, I think, some innovative things, particularly with our management team. We did something unique in that we offered them a 1% stipend to learn some technology skills. And another thing we did with that was we said that's only good for 3 years. Those skills will terminate and we'll need to relook at this whole thing at the end of 3 years and come up with a whole new list of skills that are now applicable. So I think there are a number of challenges that we're facing, and those are just some of them.
Let me ask Assemblywoman Doucher. I know we're a former school teacher or an educator. One of the big stakeholders, as Ken mentioned, are policymakers. And you know, when we started getting into this debate, AEA heavily last year, we couldn't figure out really how to move this issue because of it's such a difficult one at federal level and the state level. So I'm just curious, in Sacramento today, is there a sensitivity to the need to be innovative in education? Do you think that, or are you kind of a one-trick pony on that subject?
Well, I'll give you a case in point. I have two bills in Sacramento today that provide for what I would call industry teachers to come into the classroom and teach math, science, or career education. At the K-12 level, actually President Bush has suggested an adjunct teacher program, put $40 million, which is similar to this. We're ahead of him, however. The problems implementing the K-12 bill have to do with No Child Left Behind and the definition of highly qualified teacher. That probably can be worked out if there's the will. On the community college side, however, what we've run into is objections by faculty associations that are protecting their tenure track or their part-time track and don't want a middle track for folks who want to stay in their own career but to come into the public schools or the community colleges and offer their expertise in this area. And I was very saddened this week to hear that the chair of the Appropriation Committee intended to kill that bill based on the faculty association's objections. And groups like this group can have impacts on that by giving folks who need to oppose a particular interest group the cover and the will to do it. So there are a lot of political forces that feed into whether or not reforms actually happen in Sacramento. And one legislator, and I'm going to make my best case about the value of doing this for the students versus kind of the status quo. I'm not sure my best case is going to be successful, although in the first committee I was proud to get Karen Bass to vote for the bill. She's an African-American legislator who probably, I assume, has ties to this, to that interest group. But she voted for the bill because she knew how important it was for her community to have access to this kind of professional teaching. So there are many, many barriers, and I think it is going to take a team to overcome them.
So maybe I wanted to throw a question over, and we'll get to the students, which I think are the two most important people on the panel. The industry representatives on the panel, if you can talk about, and it doesn't matter who goes first, really talk about what are you looking for as an employer in terms of 21st century skills and innovative skills. I know we got three different types of technology companies here, one being a medical device company. So if you could, if you guys could comment on that.
I'm the guy from Boeing, and we are the world's largest aerospace company. So obviously, we probably more than a lot of folks need technically literate workforce. We have an aging workforce, and we're not unique. I think industry in general has an aging workforce. The average age of our workers in Long Beach, where I'm from, is 56 years old. So we face block retirements in the very near future. And the problem we face, and indeed America faces, is that we are not training enough new scientists, engineers, mathematicians, and technically literate people to replace those who are retiring. Never mind the fact that China and India, who, let's face it, are serious economic competitors, are creating not only numerically more scientists and engineers, but on a per capita basis, they're creating more. And they have populations that far exceed ours. So you see, we're facing a serious uphill struggle. What Boeing has been doing is focusing on educator development. We've signed on to the governor's Math and Science Initiative. We were a lead funder with the UC Science Initiative, whose goal, among other things, is to ensure that all science teachers, secondary science teachers, are highly qualified by 2 years from now. We're also a lead funder, we were the lead funder, with the CSU Math Professional Development Program, which is linked to the results of EAP, the EAP testing. So those test results identify hot zones that need professional development. And we're very proud of the fact that it was our funding and our suggestion that launched that program. So to answer your question and then pass it on, We just need a technically literate workforce who is ready to step in when our large group of folks retires.
Good morning, I'm Christine McCauley from Edwards Life Sciences. Edwards is located here in Irvine, and we are a leader in treating advanced late-stage cardiovascular disease. Cardiovascular disease is the number one killer and is growing. So for us, while we are facing retirement, our average age is much lower at about 37 years old. Where we experience a challenge in our talent is the growth that we're experiencing. We cannot hire enough people to fill our needs. And so part of my job is focused on determining what talent we go out to acquire and what talent we develop internally from the skill set that we already have available. There's been a lot of discussion about the technical skills, and obviously that's a fundamental requirement. But for us, we also are looking for the life skills that have been discussed. We look for effective business communication. We find that as a key differentiator, particularly as our new college grads come out and join us. Those that are exceptional communicators, both formal and informal, both written and verbal, it's crucial for them. We are also very focused on high integrity. You know, we put products in people's bodies. We cannot have any compromise on integrity. And while that sounds like a kind of fundamental, simple skill, it's not always what we find today. And so that's a piece that's important to us, along with work ethic, and we refer to as an in-check ego. We have a lot of really smart people that come out of school, and they think that, you know, they can do their boss's job in 2 or 3 months. And seriously. So we're very challenged by the new college grads that come out of school to work with them and understand that there truly is benefit to them to live a business cycle in the job that they're in and take the lessons and learn from that and relearn and be able to apply it to the next job, the next role. The other kind of big piece for us is adaptability. You know, we've all heard that the only certain thing is that there will be change. And we have a lot of change at our company. It's very dynamic. And people need to be adaptable. They need to be flexible. They need to be comfortable with ambiguity and the problem-solving skills that it takes to be given somewhat of a vague challenge and figure it out and determine what needs to happen and how to make it work. All of those things are differentiators for the employees that we see who are truly successful, not only as leaders, but also just key individual technical contributors. We have a dual career path all the way up through the VP level on both the technical side and the leadership side. And so we spend a lot of time assessing that talent and developing them to ensure that they can maximize their potential, that they can innovate for the company and for the patients that we serve.
Cheryl Lee with Apple, and even though I'm associated really with the field education team here in Southern California, and I am an educator, I was 10 years in the classroom, if you look at the image and the, I guess, the hardcore of Apple, it is innovation. It's all about innovation. And a key concept behind that is very clearly spelled out. I don't know if any of you read this book by Dan Pink, which I kind of consider the sequel to The World is Flat, called A Whole New Mind. And he talks about a conceptual framework for innovation. And the first principle that he highlights is design, because the ability to create not only something that's truly functional, that's not hard to do, that's what Friedman calls the plain vanilla. It's what you add on to that.
Please excuse this interruption. We apologize. During the recording of this panel discussion, a portion of the audio was lost. We now resume with our moderator addressing the students.
State University, and Ryan will be going to MIT. So one of the question I had for the two of you is, what really got you interested in science? Was it what programs, what activities, classes, maybe a teacher when you're in third grade, if you remember, or possibly your good parents? If you could talk about that a little bit, that would be great.
When I was really young, like most boys, wanted to be a firefighter, but then later on kind of discovered that I could do really well with math and science, a lot better than English. Didn't really ever like reading. So kind of I knew what fields I was good in and kind of what I really liked to do, but never really knew what opportunities were out there. Then kind of growing up and coming to high school finally, was presented with all the opportunities and ideas that were out there, kind of discovered engineering, looked into it, and decided that I really would like to do that. And then was able to take classes that related to it just to see if I would be able to go into that field and do well, and kind of discovered that I would be able to. Definitely, like most schools, Tribeca Hills definitely has lots of opportunities that you can pursue to help you out and help you develop lots of these skills that are being required more and more in modern times. They probably could be pushed a little bit more, but because unfortunately, like most other schools, most teachers definitely put an emphasis just on core subjects. So all you really do in school is just learn math and science and reading and all that, and you don't really get to experience how it really is in the real world and what other stuff you will need. Every once in a while, a teacher will be able to slip in something that adds a little creativity or adds some communication to a project or some kind of assignment, but it's kind of rare that that happens, so the teachers definitely play a big part in that matter. I've been lucky to have the teachers that I've had throughout middle school and high school, because a lot of my teachers that I've had have been really excellent teachers, trying to incorporate life skills, communication skills, innovative skills, and most of everything that they teach us, and just through projects and assignments. And so I've been able to experience a lot and been able to kind of grow and develop these skills. And so furthermore, kind of discovering what I would like to do and what I would like to go into. And that's kind of it. So.
Okay, well, I've always been interested in science since elementary school. Thank you. Math and science have always been one of my strong points throughout school, and it's never really hit me as something I really like to do until high school, and I was very encouraged by a lot of my teachers. You know, they told me I had a lot of potential. It was just one of my really strong points. I'm good at what I do, and it just hit me, well, you know, science is fun, and I do like math and science, and, you know, most kids don't, and the fact that my teachers appreciated that and helped me out with that and just... you know, pushed me to do these things really helped. And also with my parents, you know, your parents need to encourage you also, and that's also a huge part of picking what you want to do with your life and things that you're interested in. And definitely Mrs. Fliegler and Mr. Kamling, he was my 11th grade chemistry teacher. He was amazing, and he's definitely one of those top teachers that I will never, ever, ever forget. And he just really helped me out, and he really pushed me, and he helped me to decide that chemistry is something that I really like doing. It's something I'm good at. It's something, it's fun to do, and I just really enjoy that. And it's really hard for teachers these days to push kids to do these things because everyone's interested in fashion and video games, and there's so much emphasis on, you know, looks and things like that. And, you know, math and science has, you know, taken a, it's kind of been pushed back, and no one really cares about these things anymore because, you know, most people or most students don't have the skills for math and science, and so it's definitely important for our teachers to push these skills with the students and help us to understand that we do use these things in the real world, even if it's something that doesn't interest you. We still need to learn these math and science skills, so yeah, that's it.
Thank you, Lisa. Boy, I tell you, if Lisa and Ryan are representative of who are graduating today, we're in pretty good shape. They have pretty good communication skills too. I know that came up earlier. So I want to throw open one question, and then I want to turn it over to the audience. I can't imagine a group of educators that doesn't have a lot of questions. Two of the things that came up, people saw that we produced a video last night. Some people here in the room saw it, where I actually got to interview educators, teachers, parents, students, and several themes kept coming up throughout the interview, and there are two that I want to mention and throw it open to the panel. And one was that we need to teach critical thinking skills, and Ken mentioned that in his slides. That came up repeatedly. And then also the issue of having field experience to get outside of the classroom. And, you know, it just seems to me, it struck me as that making a lot of sense, and I'm just wondering, why isn't you know, why isn't more of that happening? You know, why aren't we getting out in the field and having more field experience where the kids can, you know, see things practically? The work that Randy Hudson's doing in Baja right now in particular, why are we not doing more of that, both critical thinking skills and field experience? Is it pushing students to pass the standardized tests? You know, what's going on here?
Well, one of the things I've kind of been grown or been raised thinking I have to go into a good school and will have succeeded because I will be attending MIT, and that I've had to work really hard at just the basic subjects in order to do that. And I've noticed kind of in now that I've been taking mainly AP classes, with a lot of classes that people are pushed to take and that they think they're going to need to take in order to succeed, it feels like there's a really big time constraint just because they have to teach all the material, all the subject matter just in this time before the AP test, and the teachers don't have time to integrate any of these other skills that we really kind of need in an actual career. All they have time to do is just teach us, you know, what calculus is, how to do it, what physics is, how to do it, and we don't really get to work on other skills because it's just there's so little time that they have to teach us or get us prepared for a test. And then sometimes the test doesn't even matter because some schools don't even take, or like less schools are even taking the AP tests, yet we're still being pushed to take them. And then afterwards, sometimes we can work on innovative skills, doing projects and stuff like that, but it's just there seems to be not as much of a push to work on these type of skills, and it just seems like there's not as much of an opportunity. And sometimes the teachers will find opportunities and find time in order to help out by creating projects and doing trips, but it's just it seems like the teachers themselves don't even have the opportunity and the time to be able to do what they want to with the kids to teach them these skills and help further them as people in workforce and just with those types of skills. And yeah,
I'd like to jump in here. My son graduated from Brown a few years ago and applied for a job at McKinsey & Company. That's a very high-powered consulting firm. And the question they asked him was, pretend you're the CEO of an airline, and they gave him some data, some facts, and make a recommendation whether we should offer free headsets or not. That was his job interview. And that's very like the question that Ken raised with the mayor. You can't help but agree with what he said about NCLB testing. The test isn't perfect, but it has told us where the hot spots are. I think the next step is for all of us together to think about the kind of test that we need in California, the kind of assessments that we need in California that will allow a student to get that job at McKinsey or wherever. And we're not there yet. I think everybody knows we're not there yet. But also not to forget that algebra, knowing algebra, is the gateway to critical thinking. And more studies are telling us that. And so for people who say, well, the high school exit exam is, you know, a bad thing, pre-algebra is on there. Algebra really isn't, but high standards are important. But we need to go above that in the assessment. What we assess in California for all of our high schools will get taught. And if we put on those tests questions like the McKinsey question or the Mayer question, we will see that in our schools. So I think one of the big drivers is for all of us together to push for and demand that kind of testing.
Dr. McKinney, you want
to? Yeah, let me weigh in here. You know, it's hard to argue with what I heard Ryan talking about, and Assemblyperson Lynn Dauscher is really on target. Unfortunately, the vast majority of our teaching force today were taught that content was the key, that regurgitation was the most important factor, and in society, that's still what we're weighing in on. That's what we're looking at API test scores in the paper, that's what we're being evaluated on. And I've often said, you know, show me where the basket is and I've got a good shot of getting the basket or getting a goal. But if I don't even know where the basket is, it's hard to get it. Currently, the basket is content. And we have an excellent workforce in doing what is being evaluated at this point. But we really need to change and really focus on integrating the content into 21st century skills. We put a heavy focus in Fullerton on project-based learning, trying to incorporate the content into things that are meaningful to children, things that are meaningful to the faculty members, but that takes more time and energy. It doesn't come to us that way. It's brought in as content, and it takes a huge amount of time for our faculty to integrate that content into project-based learning. You heard last night, those of you that were there, that we have over 2,000 of our students that are using laptops on a daily basis. And we're seeing some fantastic results in the schools where that's going on, where they can actually take the laptop home at night and use it. But if you were to talk to a teacher like Gigi, who is using that on an everyday basis, it is a lot more work initially to get started, because you have to make those transitions. It's not about teaching the technology. Too many people think that that's what we're involved in. It's not. It's the integration. It's using technology as a tool that is a critical factor, and that takes time. You need time to reflect on what you're doing, to think about how you're going to integrate and make this truly meaningful in the classroom. And we're trying through our professional learning communities to free up teachers so they have time to do that. But with the economy in California the way it is, it's tough to eke those kind of things out. Kit Dameron, who's in the audience here, put a lot of time into putting a PE program together after school to generate funds so that she could release teachers. It wasn't part of her base budget.
As a business partner, we try to assist with that by offering professional development for both in-service as well as pre-service. And with the in-service development that we try to fund, we engage innovative partners like the Discovery Science Center, Sally Ride Science. We know, and it's been said here, that the coursework has to be relevant to the student in order to excite them and to get them engaged. And we applaud that effort, and we like I said, we work with not only innovative sources like the science centers, but also we have willing partners with the districts we work with. I was at a meeting. I was asked to talk to a group from the San Diego School District. I work a lot with the Long Beach District. And the San Diego folks asked the question, how do we take advantage of the businesses in our community? And I said, you're asking the wrong question. You need to ask, how can you partner with the businesses in your community and meet their needs as an employer?
Okay. Well, I'd like to spend the next 10 minutes by throwing it open to the audience for questions. If you could, when you ask a question, just identify yourself and who you're with, whether it's a school or a business. Any questions from our audience for our panelists? On global awareness? So the question is on what's being done in terms of global awareness. Anyone want to comment on that?
Well, let me jump in one more time. I think that technology certainly is providing us with the tools. Programs like Google Earth, which are just fantastic, provide you some of the hands-on. But we're implementing programs down into the middle grades on international baccalaureate programs, which then go on up into the high school, and I believe that has a strong focus on global education. And I see a lot of promise. We're taking some things out of the one school, we're implementing that, and using some of those learnings to go into some of our other schools also.
Yes.
From the employer perspective, we have more than 40% of our employees outside the U.S., and so global skills are crucial to the success of our business. And it's been interesting. We find the employees who have global awareness, obviously, to be much more successful, but we've struggled as an employer how to build these skills in, and we're working on, you know, cross-cultural skills. We do a lot with international assignments, putting people out there. And we've tried to work through those experiences to say what really matters, what makes the difference. And we find that it's people's willingness to adapt to that culture and learn from the culture. It's not so much the work that they go and do, but it's that learning and relearning and the adaptability that they have, the comfort that they have to go and do that. And so, you know, it's one thing to teach it in a classroom and in a textbook, but we found that really the best is letting people go and experience, whether it's a short-term or long-term assignment, which is complicated, you know, and has challenges, but it really seems to yield the best results for us.
Did you have,
yes,
she had one more comment?
And one of the things we're seeing, just in terms of the expansion of the capabilities of the technology and how it's making an impact in the classroom, is the ability for students with a $100 camera to connect with any classroom anywhere in the world, as long as the internet, as long as the network administrator lets you out, but which is another issue with creating digital learning environments that are really conducive to a collaborative environment across the country, across nations. We have a really wonderful project right here in Orange County in Orange Unified with a teacher who has connected, and her students who have connected with like 7 or 8 other countries in a special project called Rock Our World, where they created a progressive musical composition. And this is just a start to opening doors between cultures, but it's only the technology lets you get there, and the policies and procedures around how the adults understand that learning environment that really allow it to happen or not to happen.
In terms of what Sacramento is doing for the basis, I've carried legislation, and I know the department through Bill Habermill is very involved in the technology backbone so that all school districts have access to rapid and you know, the internet, and we can put things on the internet that can be shared. We can do online learning, all kinds of things, and you should be proud of our County Department of Education because they are a leader in this, but the state is investing quite heavily in this backbone, which ties into not only K-12 but higher ed too. We're all going to be on the same backbone network. In fact, we even talked about in committee devoting some money so that the state would purchase for K-12 databases, and we can do it a lot more cost effectively than if each school district does, and this would be available to all the districts. So we're moving in this direction also.
I think Superintendent Habermill, you had a question?
We have a statewide educational system, and in grades 2 through 11, we have over 4,000 standards in California. And so what we really need to do, and I'd love to hear the panel, how do we start to get that reduced down to a
I think that goes right to the assessment question that I raised, and I think we did something. It was, you know, the first time. Now we need to refine it, and that effort will come from folks like you making that demand, along with us on the government, on the state, you know, Board of Education, and all the educational establishments that control that.
From a process standpoint. Our moderator commented on my interesting title of Global Talent Management and Executive Compensation. And there's a reason that Edwards and my team, we've decided to do that. We've put the talent with the money, because in the past, we had talent acquisition and talent development happening on its own, and we had the money, the rewards, the incentives for people happening in a separate area. And we've now put those together, and it's very interesting what you do when people understand what they will get paid for and how they will be recognized and rewarded. So I don't, you know, very kind of simple answer, but it's together for a reason, because we're looking to incentivize certain behaviors, certain skill sets, certain learnings, and we're making sure that we're delivering on that commitment to the employees to tell them what it takes and then deliver through our equity and cash benefits compensation. So if you have 4,000 and someone's incentivized to get it to 400, you know, perhaps there's a connection to how people, whoever is overseeing this, gets paid to pull that down. And that may be very simplistic, but if no one's incentivized on their own level to make a change, you know, why? There's got to be that driving factor. And as much as people want to say, well, I'm not motivated by money and that doesn't matter, it may not be money, it may be recognition, visibility, exposure, more growth opportunity, but there's something there that triggers people. And it sounds like with your stipend, you know, perhaps you saw some of that and how the incentive can tie to the results.
There were a number of people that said, you know, we really shouldn't do that, and merit pay is not exactly a favorite word of educators. But I remember when we first talked about this, there was a certain amount of complaining that took place. But I can tell you today that out of about 85 administrators, only two haven't passed that. And part of the critical part was that the stipend started on a certain day, and it went for 3 years. At the end of that time, it was done. So if somebody took 2.5 years to get that competency, they only got compensated for 6 months. And I think that people do need incentive to make changes. It really does work, and I think we need to do more of that in education.
I think we had a couple questions from the audience. Yes.
I've often asked myself why California's at such a low level of per student, and one of the answers is that we have more students per 100 or whatever measure you want to take. We have a disproportionate number of students versus the tax base here compared to other states. So when you have more of something, you divide it in, you get a lower number per student. This year, student population is pretty flat. And in addition to that, we have lots of money this year that is going to be allocated to education. And I think for the first time in many, many years, you're going to see California's per student amount up to the national average. That we won't know that for 3 years because that's when it's calculated, but the legislative analyst tells us that he thinks that it will be at the national average, which will be a first. So I think we will see a much better time for education going forward than we have in the past very, you know, difficult years.
Yes.
I'm just curious, what role do you see artificial intelligence playing in the assessment piece after the polling?
I don't know about the future, but I do know that we certainly have seen some interesting products out there that are in use in our schools now for scoring writing exams. And the key efficiency here is that without a product like this and the huge class sizes that we're talking about, how do you give students enough of a chance to write, to practice writing, which is a key intellectual skill. And what we're seeing is the fall off of those opportunities in classrooms where the professional development and the teacher involvement has been to learn how to use products like this. You're seeing an incredible increase in student writing as well as performance on tests. So there has been some discussion about national online assessments, although one of the things that I think it's important to also make a distinction between is the chance to practice and write versus being assessed. I mean, in a sense, it is an assessment cycle, but it's also it's writing to learn. It's an assessment to learn. So how broad will that be? I mean, I think in terms of efficiencies, cost efficiencies, it's going to be a model that will continue. And as one of the main drawbacks we've seen is access, simply having enough access to computers in order to, you know, pull a cycle of students through and to get your results in time. But it, in terms of data-driven instruction, which is the model that we live by, it is probably one of the most efficient and one that has the most, I think, benefits for students in the long run, because they get the chance to do what they need to do, which is to write and get immediate feedback. I was a writing teacher, not feedback in a week or 2 weeks after I've dragged those papers back and forth to school, because it's a very difficult thing when you've got 150 kids a day and you're trying to give them practice with writing. So those are some of the challenges, but I do think now that access and bringing laptops into classrooms more frequently and not having to go to labs and all of that will increase the use of online assessment. It's just what kinds of assessments will we be able to do with the technology?
So I think it started off slow. I'm told I'm only supposed to take one more question, and I think this gentleman over here had his hand up.
I have a question. In business, you constantly have to be on top of what you're doing with your skill sets, of being flexible to meet the needs of your customer. If you don't do that, you're not going to be standpoint of our education system. If you're looking at the rankings that were presented earlier, you can see that there's a national and a global problem that's out there that ought to drive moving things quicker. I think what we found, there are too many generalist teachers in the classroom. There aren't enough subject matter experts in science and math. The students have talked about one or two teachers that, with extra effort, have guided them along in their careers. There are certain requirements you have to graduate from every level of education. There are requirements that you have to graduate from college that influence what's going to happen in pre-service of teachers. What will it take to get the requirements changed so that you move away from theory into practical applications in the classroom and drive that into the requirements for graduation so that we can start to see some results in the classroom with professional development? Because we're not going to have what you can have the budget there. You can have too many things that you're driving to move forward in grading out on these measurements. At some point, you have to bring in what is practical, drive it down so that you can start to make sure that you've got the hands-on experience for people that are coming out of school. I'm interested in hearing what that's going to be.
Who wants to take that one?
Well, I would go back to assessment. I think, you know, the high stakes assessment really has grabbed everybody's attention, and you get what you assess. And I think if we change the assessment to more mirror what we want, we will see a change in what the outputs are.
I think there's another aspect to it, and it is that elephant in the room, and that is the economics. We have a very serious problem in Orange County retaining excellent staff members. It's next to impossible for a brand new teacher starting off around $40,000 a year to live in Fullerton. When the average cost of a home is somewhere around $550,000, I mean, it just doesn't compute. We're trying to do things creatively in terms of trying to get housing at the city. The colleges are working to try and get somewhat of a subsidized housing available within our area. And the colleges have been relatively successful. We're trying to work with them on that to provide the same type of thing for our teachers. But in order to compete and get some of the best and brightest people in the areas of science, math, technology, we have to pay higher salaries than what we're paying. It's embarrassing going out. I was in personnel for a number of years and competing. I mean, you like to be in an audience where all you're competing for is educators. But when you go out into a workforce where you're competing with businesses that are paying much higher salaries, it's very, very difficult to attract the kind of quality that we need. We need to have more money. When I went back to Henrico, West Virginia, and was looking at the program there where they had whole districts with kids that had laptops in them, and we were trying to figure out, how did you do this? We found out, well, basically they had about $2,000 more per kid. They had been setting aside $500 per year for technology alone and had been doing that for years. We had a number of people look at our budget and say, you know, how can we look at looking at the Fullerton School District budget and take some money out of the existing budget to afford more technology? And the answer was, we were stretching every cent that we had. There was no secret fund in there that we could dig that money out of. And so we had to get creative, and some of you read about some of the things in the paper that we've done. But basically, it was whatever it took to make it happen. My daughter, who some of you saw last night, who's in sixth grade, can't wait another 10 years for the legislature, for the governor, whoever else is going to provide the funding. We've got to do things for our kids now. And if it takes a certain amount of acrimony in the press, so be it.
Well, I want to thank our panelists, but for those of you who saw our video last night, you heard what Lynn's colleague Todd Spitzer said about teacher salaries. So he believes the starting salary should be, or not starting, but the a good salary for a teacher is around $100,000 a year. So we'll see if we'll ever get to that point. I want to thank our panelists for coming here today. Boy, Julie, this is a big topic. We could go a long time on this, but I know the program needs to move along, and maybe for the next session we get together, we'll dig deeper here. Thank you again to our panelists. Give them a round of applause.